Right, so I'm sure that you have all got great memories. You all remember that our verse for the year is that Jesus said that he'd come, that we could have life and have it to the full. And one of the ways that we're exploring what life to the full is like is by looking at different people in the Bible and seeing, you know, what life to the full looked like for them. So if you've been here for some of them, then, for example, a few weeks back we looked at Rahab, and she was in the Old Testament the new convert who was entrusted and rewarded by God. And we can see how God gives great things in the hands of people who we maybe don't think are very capable ourselves as in the church. We looked at Jeremiah, the weeping prophet who found solace in God and found the presence of God in amongst the suffering. Steve told us about Mordecai and the donkey and the robe, we had a message about service being with a blessing. And these are different aspects of life to the full. And we're going to get to the real heart today about what life to the full is about. And we're going to do it through the eyes of someone who we don't even know the name of, and someone who the Bible describes as a woman, but as we'll see as we work through it, is probably actually someone who we would describe as a girl. But we'll get to that. So the time and the place. We're in Jerusalem in Jesus' day. And it's autumn. It's the harvest season, and it's the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, as the Jews would call it. And the way the celebration worked in Jesus' time was in accordance with a pattern set down by Moses in the Old Testament. Then to celebrate the harvest coming in, then they would build, amongst other things, they would build sort of wicker booths, the Bible calls them, like little sort of arbors or something like that, little wicker sort of huts on top of their houses. Of course, the houses being flat-roofed affairs in that time, and they'd sleep in these little sort of huts over the course of about a week, and the loads of people would come into Jerusalem from the countryside to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, and the food and the drink would flow, and there'd be a great party atmosphere, and it was one of the great celebrations. Apparently, it was the time even more than the Passover that people used to come into Jerusalem to celebrate the feast. And in this sort of feast, then we have a young girl. She was probably, if we read between the lines of the story, she was probably betrothed to be married to someone. And so the way that marriage worked in Jewish days is in Jesus' day, then your parents, if you, would sort of try and find a partner for for their children, for their boy or their girl. So arranged marriages were the thing, and that would normally happen when the boy was about 16 to 18, or for girls it was when they were about 12 or 13. So then you'd have this natural sort of age gap between the two. And And after then, you have your kind of initial handshake on the contract between the parents saying, yep, right, my daughter's going to marry your son. And then there would be a year of negotiations as they sort out important things like dowries and where they're going to live and all that kind of thing. And so you have this sort of years period where, which is kind of, I suppose, in a way, kind of corresponds to our engagement, but where the parents have agreed that the two kids are going to get married, and they're just working out exactly how all the details of how it's going to happen. And the important thing about this period is you weren't properly married, but you were kind of promised to be married. So you carry on living with your parents, but there was to be no or should we say hanky-panky during the betrothal period. And this is kind of quite unlike sort of Roman custom, which you might have heard me talk about before, where they had a kind of a level of sexual expression that they celebrated that was not permitted in Jewish society. And during this time of betrothal, this girl had some attention, shall we say, from another man. And we don't know whether that was something that she actively sought out and encouraged, or whether it was something that he had started. And we don't know if it was planned and calculated and been going on for a long time, or whether they'd become swept away in the party atmosphere of the Feast of Tabernacles. But whatever. One thing led to another. The Bible's not a bodice ripper. It doesn't give us these details. One thing led to another, and the two of them find themselves in bed together. So the girl was betrothed to someone and another man. And at that time, filling in the details, because the Bible doesn't ink in all the details on this part for us, but it seems that something would have happened, like the door crashes open whilst they're in bed together, and two men, it would have had to have been men, are standing there, and they can see exactly what's going on. And one of the tests for whether or not it was rape, rather than whether she'd actually agreed to this, was whether or not she was screaming. So presumably she wasn't screaming at the time, because otherwise people would have heard her. And so this woman gets, this girl, probably 12 or 13, gets taken to the religious authority. The partner is, the man that she was in bed with disappears somewhere. Don't know whether he's released, or whether he, you know, maybe he has some powerful connections and they didn't want to embarrass his important family. But whatever it was, then this woman is taken, and she's taken to the religious authorities, because what she's done isn't a crime as far as the Roman civil law is concerned. It's a crime as far as the Jewish religious law. And no doubt she's absolutely terrified. She's brought shame on her family. Her marriage is in jeopardy. Who's going to have her now, right? The man she's betrothed to is probably not going to be interested in her. So other women will reject her. Can't trust this woman around my husband. And she's kind of, you can see her life is flashing before her. Maybe a life of prostitution or begging is what she's expecting to have. And having been questioned by the religious authorities, she then gets dragged at dawn through the city streets to the temple courts, where there's a crowd. And she's pushed to the front of the crowd, and she finds herself face to face with Jesus. And the religious teachers who she'd been taken to, they stand in front of this large crowd and they announce her crime in all its sordid detail to the gathered crowd and to Jesus. And they say, "We found this woman," this young girl, as we'd say, "we found this woman and we caught her in the very act of adultery." So before we kind of dig into the passage a bit more, it's worth just taking stock, you know, because the Bible is sort of, you know, we're meant to engage with the Bible, right? And not just read it as a dry historical document. How do you feel about this girl? You know, I mean, how do you feel about what she's done? Are you sort of thinking, well, she's betrayed her betrothed husband, and she's a bit of a, well, I'll avoid using the kind of words that could be used to describe what she's done. Do you think that maybe she deserves anything that might happen to her? Or maybe you're a bit more sympathetic. Perhaps you just think that she's young and hormonal and she's been a little bit silly and we should just kind of ignore what she's done, because, you know, it's the kind of thing that everyone does, really, isn't it? Perhaps you kind of take a slightly more intellectual view and you think she's a victim of a patriarchal society that's attempting to control and direct her natural right to sexual expression. I don't know. What do you think? What kind of camp are you in? It's interesting to compare the camp that we naturally fall into to the camp that Jesus falls into. So let's read the start of the story. It's in John chapter 8, if you want to follow it, or if you prefer, you can just listen to me. And it says that each one went to his own home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, and at dawn he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him. And he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said this to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?" And they were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. So, why do you think these Pharisees and the teachers of the law, involved Jesus in this affair of the betrothed girl who'd been engaging in a little bit of extramarital affair. And one thing's clear, right? The Pharisees had no love for Jesus at all. And they thought that they knew the Bible a whole lot better than he did. And so they were not really very interested in learning what insights Jesus had into the Old Testament. So although they're coming to him and saying, what does the Bible say we should do with this person? They didn't really care what his answer was, right? They had no respect for him at all. And so that's why John sort of notes that it was a trap. And the trap was this. Jesus was seen by many of the people as a rabbi or a teacher, but he wasn't kind of part of the official teaching establishment. And and many of the people listened to his teachings and to his reading of the Old Testament, right? And Jesus would have known all about Moses' teaching on adultery, which we'll come to in a moment. But we also know from later on in John's Gospel that the Jewish religious authorities, although they had some legal basis for their courts and so on, they didn't actually have authority to execute anyone. And adultery wasn't a capital offence under Roman law. So if Jesus said, so this is the trap they're laying for Jesus. They're either saying, are you going to undermine Moses' teaching, in which case we can tell people not to listen to anything that you say about the Bible, or do you want to tell us to execute this woman, and then we'll set the Romans on you and they'll slap you in prison for murder? A fairly straightforward trap. But we need to just think a little bit more closely about what Moses said. And what Moses said is how we've been able to fill in some of the details about the background to this girl that might not have been obvious to you. Moses said this in Deuteronomy. If a man, he describes three different scenarios of extramarital sex and what needs to happen. He says, if a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, then both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. You must purge the evil from Israel. That was the first scenario. Then he says, if a man happens to meet in a town a virgin pledged to be married and he sleeps with her, then you shall take both of them to the gate of the town and stone them to death. The young woman, because she was in a town and didn't scream for help, and the man, because he violated another man's wife. You must purge the evil from among you. So that was the second scenario. And the third scenario is this. But if you're out in the country and a man happens to meet a young woman pledged to be married and rapes her, only the man who's done this shall die. Do nothing to the woman. She's committed no sin, deserving death. So we've got three scenarios that Moses describes. The first one is two married people, and they, or one person's married, and they agree to have sex outside their marriage. And Moses says, well, both people, they've got to be executed. But when someone is betrothed, then the means of execution is determined. It's by stoning. And that's how we know that this girl was betrothed rather than married, is because the Pharisees are turning up and saying she's got to be stoned. And that's the only one scenario in which Moses says that somebody was to be stoned. And then finally, you get a scenario where it's unclear whether the woman consented to what went on. In a city, they say, well, you know, anyone who's being raped in a city is going to scream. Well, the houses are all piled on top of each other. They're not very soundproof like ours. And if she screams, then someone kind of will know. They'll have heard it. And so you can understand what's going on in the city. And that's the presumption of consent or not consent. But in the country, then there's no one to hear. And therefore, you presume that the girl was innocent, because there's no evidence to the contrary. So why is this important, that we kind of understand the exact kind of offence, if you like, that's been committed here? Well, remember, all through Jesus' life, then rumours would have been circulating about his own mother. And the Pharisees didn't believe in the virgin birth, for sure. And they would have been pretty clear that either Joseph and Mary had were responsible before they were married for Mary's pregnancy, or, as Joseph had originally thought, that Mary had been unfaithful. And so they're having a double dig here. They're partly trying to trap Jesus, and they're partly asking him to pass judgment on his own mother. should Mary have been executed for what she did? And so they asked their question. Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery, and the law Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say? Now, it's interesting, isn't it? They had clearly no interest in true justice and fairness. If they did, if they were really interested in justice and fairness, then they wouldn't have brought one person before Jesus. They'd have brought two. They'd have brought the bloke as well. But he was off scot-free. He'd escaped. Maybe he'd escaped being too powerful, well-connected. Maybe it was just the age-old prejudice that has run through so many societies, through so many generations and decades and centuries, that that promiscuity is okay for lads. And we normally use the word lad in the context of it, but only cheap girls sneak around. Perhaps it was that. I don't know. But whatever it was, they were only interested in setting up the girl and not the bloke. So they weren't really interested in justice and fairness. They weren't interested in the circumstances. They weren't interested in trying to have any kind of proper legal process. They didn't have the man's testimony. Maybe. I mean, who knows? It doesn't appear they'd inquired. Maybe he'd plied her with drink against her knowledge. She was young and maybe didn't understand the consequences of drinking so much wine. And then he'd persuaded her that way. Perhaps she didn't have mental capacity. I don't know. Was the consent genuine? There's only a presumption of consent because she wasn't screaming. So they weren't really interested in getting to the circumstances. They weren't interested in justice. They weren't interested in the effect that their question had on the woman. They just assumed that she was guilty without trial, and they were quite happy to publicly humiliate her in order to get at a point that they wanted to score against Jesus. And interestingly, they didn't even have any interest in Jewish legal history because, you know, remember, at the time of Jesus, then all of the Jews were descended from the tribe of Judah or Benjamin or Levi because the other tribes had been lost as a result of the nation of Israel having been conquered. So Judah was by far the biggest of these tribes. Most of the Pharisees there would have been descendants of Judah. The founder of their own tribe, Judah himself, was responsible for adultery when he fathered a child through his own daughter-in-law, who he mistook for a prostitute. So but he wasn't executed for it, right? So they're not interested in Jewish legal history. How come the law of Moses wasn't enforced there? They weren't interested in the Jewish legal history about why David wasn't executed after what he did with Bathsheba. They weren't interested in the Jewish history about why Hosea's wife wasn't executed when she was unfaithful to him, and so on and so on. They just wanted something to pin Jesus up. They were prepared to see someone executed in order to score theological points. What I'd say to that is this, right? No, we have to uphold the Bible's teaching, but we've got to put people and mercy and justice at the heart of our church. So the Pharisees were really behaving with pretty low integrity. And Jesus responds. Now, there's a famous cartoon that many of you might have seen. It's an XKCD cartoon for the technologists. It's a picture of a man hunched over a computer, and he's having a conversation with his wife, who's off the picture, you know, out in the next room. And the voice comes floating in, "Are you coming to bed?" And he answers, "I can't. This is important." "What?" And then he replies, "Someone's wrong on the internet," you know, and he's there, you know, I have to reply. Someone said something wrong. I've got to deal with it. Got to answer the question. Well, Jesus is not like the man in the XKCD cartoon who has to immediately deal with a question that he's been asked. Let's read the rest of the passage. So we're in the second half of verse 6, and it says this in John chapter 8, "But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. And when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, 'If any of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her.' And again, he stooped down and he wrote on the ground." It's great, isn't it? All these people hassling him with questions, and what does he do? He bends over and just starts writing on the ground with his finger. So I suppose the question is, why does he do it? The Bible doesn't tell us what he wrote, and loads of people have speculated endlessly about what he wrote, but we don't have a clue what he wrote, right? We just don't know. And if it was important to the story, we would know, wouldn't we, right? It would be there. So it's obviously not important what he wrote. Maybe he just kind of drew smiley faces or something like that. I don't know. He just wrote on the ground. But the first thing that it did was this, is it gave time for the whole situation to defuse. Time to think. It gave him time to think, right? It gave the crowd time to think, and it gave the Pharisees some time to think as well. And that delaying tactic was just a great way of making sure that this didn't get out of control into a shouting argument. But there's something else about it, right? There are two instances in the Old Testament that you find of a finger writing. The first finger writing that we know about was the finger of God writing out the law on tablets of stone on Mount Sinai in the presence of Moses. And the second time that we find a finger writing is the finger of God writing on the wall of Belshazzar's palace on the night of his feast, where God writes, "Meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin, you've been weighed in the balances, found wanting." And in writing with his finger on the ground, then Jesus is saying, what I'm about to tell you is the voice of God. Now, just going back to the question and the way that Jesus dealt with this, I'd say this. Like we do, as that SKCD cartoon that I cited, live in an instant world where you can have an argument in real time with one person who's in China and another person who's in Australia and a third person who's in Canada, right? And we can kind of be in this world where we're afraid to take, everything's instant, and we're afraid to take time to think. And sometimes arguing can become an end in itself. And what we can learn from the way the Pharisees behaved is this, is that opponents of Christianity and the opponents of the Christian faith often try to discredit believers by trying to put them on the spot with awkward questions. You've seen recently in our election campaign attempts to make Christian politicians make illiberal remarks. You know, it seems that interviewers, if they're presented with a Christian politician, are really only interested in finding out what sort of obscure Christian belief they can get them to confess to. As we've seen, people like Tim Farron being hounded over his Christianity by some parts of the media. Or attempts by people to try and make Christians look foolish by simplistically pitting science against the Bible and getting Christians to shoot from the hip on these things. And we can get drawn in. And Jesus shows us that sometimes it's best to just not get drawn in, right? An argument for an argument's sake does nothing to help real people. And what we want is to reveal God and not win an argument. And what Jesus is about to do is to reveal God. And in giving his answer, Jesus doesn't say whether the woman is guilty or should be punished. Because when he says that if any of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. Right, her technical guilt is pretty self-evident, right? She herself isn't claiming to be innocent. And Jesus doesn't engage in a technical argument about when the law of Moses should be applied and start discussing Judah and David and Gomer, which was Hosea's wife. And instead, he turns the question completely around and gets people to think about their own lives. Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at them.
Now, let's be clear, because this passage can be quite easily misunderstood. He doesn't say that what she's done is unimportant. I mean, let's be clear, right? Her betrothed husband is probably, if he's got to hear about it, because this is, you know, happened overnight, but her betrothed husband is probably pretty devastated at this moment. And her parents are probably pretty devastated too. And so, you know, Jesus isn't saying that sexual misbehavior is victim-free. He's not saying that what's happened is unimportant. And so, you know, it's easy to quickly misread this passage and to say that standards of behavior don't matter in the church. But they do. But here, Jesus is inviting us to look at ourselves and not look at others, and look at our own patterns of behavior. And he probably means, when he says, let any of you who is without sin, he probably actually means, and they probably took it to mean, if any of you is without the sin of adultery, then be the first to throw the stone at her. Not completely without sin. So how do the Pharisees respond? Well, we find it further down in the passage in verse 8, and it says this, on verse 9, at this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with a woman still standing there. And Jesus straightened up, and he asked her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir, she said. Then neither do I condemn you, Jesus declared. Go now and leave your life of sin. Now, I've seen many surveys, most of them in American, but I expect that British folk are kind of similar. I've seen many surveys that show that a pretty high proportion of evangelical Christians have at some time during their married life been unfaithful to their partner. And I'll avoid trying to catch anyone's eye in case there are any of you here who are in that position. Because if we're a typical church, then some of you will have been in that position. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we should start an inquiry into finding out who's misbehaved in this way? Drag the person out? Make them repent in front of the whole church? This is what Jesus is saying we shouldn't do. Instead, he's saying that we've got responsibility for making sure that we stay faithful to our own partners, more so than making sure that everyone else stays faithful to theirs. He puts the responsibility, he puts the ball firmly back in our court. My responsibility is to Sarah. Your responsibility is to your partner. And Jesus' contemporaries are much the same as modern people. And I don't think that they did opinion polls in Roman times, but if they did, they'd probably have found that many Pharisees had been unfaithful to their partners as well. And I suspect that that many of them had a sudden flashback and when Jesus put that question at them, and that's when they started to beat a hasty retreat. I'm not sure why it was the oldest first. Perhaps they'd had longer to misbehave, or maybe they were just a bit less hot-headed. But the oldest, the youngest, start disappearing until there's no one left. It seems that the crowd disappears as well, because they don't want to get caught up in this, because nobody wants to have their lives questioned in that much detail. And there's no one left except the woman. Now, the interesting thing is, why didn't the woman go? Because there's no one stopping her. Jesus is still kneeling at this point. He hasn't got his, tied up in rope or anything like that. But there's just a woman left, and Jesus stands up, having been crouching down, writing in the dust, and he just asks the obvious question, where's everyone gone? Like, there was a crowd here a few moments ago. What's happened? And then the woman is let off, if you like, on a legal technicality. Because crimes needed the testimony of two witnesses, but there are none left. I mean, you know, it could be that Jesus has heard the woman kind of confess to what she's done, but he's only one witness anyway. So there is no one to condemn her. So under Jewish law, under Roman law, needing two witnesses, it was impossible for her to be convicted. So when Jesus says, then neither do I condemn you, then he's making a statement of legal fact. He can't condemn her. There are no witnesses. But the attitude of the woman is instructive, right? Or the girl. She doesn't falsely proclaim her innocence. She doesn't try to excuse her behavior. She doesn't kind of come out with all these things. Well, you don't understand me, Jesus. My husband, my betrothed husband is boring, or he's too poor to look after me, or he's ugly and he doesn't interest me, or he's impotent and he can't give me children, or he doesn't understand me. You know, he bullies me. I was tricked. He raped me. She doesn't make all these excuses. Right? She just, by her silence, admits what she's done. And in the face of her honesty and humility, then Jesus now can deal with her and say to her, go and leave your life of sin. And so Jesus points out that she's been sinful. This is not a whitewash, right? This is not a case of saying that her behavior doesn't matter. But he tells her to go, almost like saying you've had a narrow escape. But he tells her to go with her past having been forgiven, but with the future to be completely different. Go and sin no more. So it was sin, otherwise she didn't need to sin no more. So what have we learned? Well, we've learned the simple point that we've got to be wise, like Jesus was, in dealing with people who ask us questions with improper motives. And we've learned that we need to put people, we need to put love, we need to put mercy, we need to put grace, we need to put truth, and not legal technicalities at the heart of our theological debates. But third, and most importantly, we've learned the most important thing, that life to the full happens when you come to God for grace and you sin no more. Now, not many of us have been caught literally with our pants down, like this girl was, but all of us have sinned. And this is the Christian message about life to the full. That Jesus can erase the past. He can forgive it through his sacrifice for us in Calvary. And he can support you through a new start, a new birth, to use Jesus' expression. If, like the woman, you come to him humbly and without making excuses, and you face him rather than running away from him. And he can make the new life really, really, really different from the old life. And he can make it life to the full. And it's not just about salvation, although it is about salvation. Because as Christians, we can get trapped into sinful patterns of behavior. And Jesus wants you to bring your life to him. Admit your failing. And just go forward in a different way. And have life to the full, knowing God's forgiveness and living in his presence.